This is Audible.
Bichette Audio presents The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. How to know what's really real in a world increasingly full of fake. Written by Stephen Novella with Bob Novella, Kara Santamaria, Jay Novella, and Evan Bernstein. Read by Stephen Novella. Look for your Mac and PC-compatible PDF of supplemental content.
Stay tuned after the audiobook for an interview with Dr. Stephen Novella, joined by his co-authors, Robert Novella, Jay Novella, Kara Santamaria, and Evan Bernstein.
Dedicated to Perry DeAngelis, a friend and skeptic of some note. Introduction. There is a theory which states that if ever anyone discovers exactly what the universe is for and why it is here, it will instantly disappear and be replaced by something even more bizarre and inexplicable. There is another theory which states that this has already happened. Douglas Adams. Spock lied to me. And it wasn't just Spock. Well, actually Leonard Nimoy, as the host of the popular but dubious TV show In Search Of, who lied, but the media, journalists, corporations, politicians, salespeople, and just about every adult and authority figure in my life. Some were deliberately lying, while others were fudging the truth for what they thought was a good purpose. Most, however, were simply mistaken, misinformed or self-deluded, and were spreading what they assumed was the truth, but were just the lies that others told them. We all start as children believing pretty much whatever we're told. The gulf of knowledge and experience between adults and young children is so great that to a child, any adult is perceived as the ultimate authority on any topic. As we mature, we realize that not all adults agree with each other, so some of them must be wrong. We become more sophisticated in our choice of authority figures, but we still tend to rely on others to know what to think, on experts, leaders, religious figures, celebrities, talking heads, or just common knowledge. Science is another authority. When I was younger, I had an intense fascination with all things scientific. Scientists simply had the best stories to tell, how gigantic dinosaurs roamed the earth millions of years ago, how our primitive ancestors made tools out of stone, how the sun, earth, and moon formed billions of years ago, how a single cell develops into a human, and how life evolved from simple creatures to everything we see today. My brothers and I watched every TV science documentary we could find, instinctively knowing they were much better than any sitcom or hokey drama. Mixed in with science documentaries, however, were what I now know to be pseudoscience, or fake documentaries. This is where Leonard Nimoy comes in, as the host of the popular series In Search Of, which aired from 1977 to 1982. In each episode, Nimoy would narrate how scientists had discovered that aliens built the Nazca Lines, the enigmatic drawings etched into the sands of the Nazca Desert in Peru, or were on the verge of discovering a large creature living in the Loch Ness. He built a compelling case, or so I thought, for the existence of extrasensory perception, Atlantis, and Bigfoot. Just like the hosts of the other science documentaries we would watch, he would show us evidence and interview experts. We ate it up. At the same time, we were being raised as good Catholics. Looking back, it amazes me how, as a young child, I completely compartmentalized my belief in evolution and Adam and Eve. Abraham, Mary, and Joseph were historical figures to me, taught with the same authority as were the exploits of George Washington. In church, faith was taught as an absolute virtue, so being a good person meant simply believing. This exciting world of fantastic narratives that society had built in my head, evolution, Genesis, Loch Ness monsters, and many more, was not sustainable. Eventually, I had to sort out the apparent conflicts among these various narratives. The claims of evolutionary biology and a literal interpretation of Genesis could not both be true at the same time. This meant questioning and doubting. I had to figure out which narratives to believe and which ones to reject. This is the essence of skepticism. How do we know what to believe and what to doubt? Once you begin to ask questions like, how do we actually know anything? Our beliefs start to fall one by one. How would we know if aliens were visiting Earth or if sticking needles in special points on the body could cure disease? This questioning doesn't always end well, as some people will choose to reject science so they can maintain their belief in aliens or miracles. Others keep questioning. This process is never done. It's an endless journey. The question is, how far will you go, and in which direction will you head? This is ultimately a personal odyssey, but we aren't completely alone. We are part of ever-expanding social rings with which we share our quest for knowledge and understanding. The biggest ring encompasses all of humanity. As a species, we are on a journey of discovery, trying to figure out what to believe and what knowledge is reliable. Your travels will take you through some interesting and exciting twists and turns. It can be scary. At some point, you will confront a belief you really want to be true. That may even be part of your identity, but that does not stand up to close scrutiny. Ultimately, this is a journey of self-discovery, and hopefully this audiobook will serve as a guide on that journey. In this program, you will learn about the many ways in which your brain fails, its tendency to prefer nice, clean, and reassuring stories, the absolute mess that is your memory, and all the pre-programmed biases in your thinking. You will also learn about the many ways in which society fails, the imperfections in the institutions of science, learning, and journalism. It's intimidating to realize that we live in a world overflowing with misinformation, bias, myths, deception, and flawed knowledge. We are all children, and there are no adults. There are no ultimate authority figures. No one has the secret. There is no revealed knowledge, and there is no place to look up the definitive answers to our questions. Not even Google. We are all struggling through this complex universe just like everyone who came before us. Fully realizing this essence of the human condition can make you cynical, denying all knowledge. That, however, is just another bias, another narrative to help us deal with the chaos. Cynicism is also cheap. It's easy just to doubt or deny everything, but it doesn't get you or society anywhere. Skepticism goes beyond cynicism. While it may start with doubt, that's the beginning, not the end. There isn't any definitive or ultimate knowledge, no truth with a capital T, but we can grind out knowledge about the world that is sufficiently reliable for us to treat it as provisionally true and act upon it. We can, for example, send probes to Pluto and get back gorgeous pictures of a place that was previously entirely mysterious. If our knowledge of the universe wasn't at least to some degree true, then our efforts to see Pluto wouldn't have been rewarded with beautiful images of this distant and frozen world. So, while we cannot trust the stories we are told, tradition, faith, convenient or reassuring narratives, charismatic figures, or even our own memories, we can slowly and carefully build a process by which to evaluate all claims to truth and knowledge. A big part of that process is science, which systematically tests our ideas against reality, using the most objective data possible. Science is still a messy and flawed process, but it is a process. It has, at least, the capacity for self-correction, to move our beliefs incrementally in the direction of reality. In essence, science is the process of making our best effort to know what's really real. Combined with science are logic and philosophy, which are simply ways of thinking about things really carefully, to at least make sure there is no internal contradiction. Valid reasoning, careful and systematic observations, recording and counting all data, not just the data we want, and trying to disprove our own conclusions is a lot of work, but it moves us forward on our journey. Skeptics combine knowledge of science, philosophy, human psychology, and all the flaws and biases of human thinking to evaluate all claims and beliefs, especially their own. I took a major step in this direction when I watched the series Cosmos, co-written and hosted by Carl Sagan. It was perhaps the first time I saw a science documentary that didn't just state facts, but explored how we know what we know. Sagan investigated what we thought in the past and how new discoveries changed our thinking. In one episode, he dedicated a segment to questioning the alleged evidence for alien visitation. That segment was a revelation. If there was ever a moment when I tipped over into becoming a skeptic, that was it. Here was a respected scientist carefully arguing with logic and evidence why the case for UFOs was not compelling. In fact, it was utter crap. That meant that all those alien visitation documentaries, including half of the In Search Of episodes, were not just wrong. They were nonsense. I felt betrayed. Those documentaries weren't real science. They were what Sagan called a cheap imitation. They were pseudoscience. Wow, what other claims were as flimsy as the evidence for UFOs? The dominoes started to fall. My journey took another step when I encountered creationism, the denial of evolution. This blew me away. By then, I'd read dozens of books and articles on evolution, which was one of my favorite scientific topics, and I was well-versed in the mountains of evidence scientists had accumulated showing that life on Earth has evolved. Now I was reading or listening to people who denied all this evidence, denied that evolution had happened at all, or at least how scientists claim it had happened. I couldn't help but slow down and take a close look, like viewing a horrific accident on the highway. The arguments of creationists ranged from silly to sophisticated, but ultimately they were all flawed. I tried my best to understand where they went wrong. At first, I naively believed that if I could just explain to creationists, when I had the opportunity during random in-person encounters, the flaws in their reasoning or the factual errors in their premises, I could change their minds. While this isn't impossible, it proved far more difficult than I had imagined. Something was going on, something I didn't understand. I went to college as a science major, struggling with all of this and my rapidly waning faith. I was well on my way on a skeptical journey that continues to this day, 3 decades later. This obsession with understanding how we know what we know and how human beliefs go off the rails has become my life's work. I love the process and findings of science and working out how to explain all of this to others. When I discovered that there was an active skeptical movement of people with the same set of obsessions, I never looked back. One day, my close friend and fellow skeptic, Perry DeAngelis, noticed that while there were dozens of skeptical groups around the country, there were none in our home state of Connecticut. "We should start our own group," he suggested, and I knew instantly we were on the right path. We were joined by our mutual friend, Evan Bernstein, and my 2 brothers, Bob and Jay. Those are the same brothers who watched In Search Of with me as teenagers. We helped each other through those early years spent transitioning from believing all manner of nonsense to being skeptics. I still remember, well, as much as our flawed memories can record anything, the day I told Bob that I no longer thought ESP, extrasensory perception, was real. He was shocked, but a 30-minute conversation was all it took to lay out the gaping flaws in the evidence. Together, in 1996, the 5 of us created the New England Skeptical Society. We were content, sort of, to print a newsletter and host local lectures. We would have loved to be more involved, but we all had day jobs. We did go on investigations, attend UFO conventions, and confront proponents of all sorts of pseudoscience. Those were the years when we earned our bones. We also had the opportunity to meet scientists, philosophers, magicians, and other skeptical activists. Then, social media hit with full force. In 2005, when podcasting was a new thing, I had the idea of starting a weekly science and critical thinking podcast. We settled on the name The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, inspired by The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy series of books we all love. SGU for short. As of writing this book, we are still going strong. Along the way, we picked up a fellow traveler, Rebecca Watson, who co-hosted the show for 9 years. We also lost Perry, who died in 2007 from complications of scleroderma. We were joined by a new skeptical rogue, as we call ourselves, in 2015, Cara Santamaria. Every week, the five of us try to make sense of what seems like an increasingly crazy world. The internet and social media have been a mixed blessing, allowing us to teach science and critical thinking to a far wider audience, but also facilitating the spread of misinformation like never before. In the last 2 decades, while we've been fighting for science and reason, it seems like the stakes have only gotten higher. My own profession, medicine, has been thoroughly infiltrated by the pseudoscience of so-called alternative medicine. The very process of science is under attack. There are entire movements dedicated to denying and opposing the hard-won fruits of scientific discovery. And now it seems that truth and facts themselves are easily tossed aside as an inconvenience. There are those who think, with good reason, that humanity is stepping back from the Enlightenment to huddle in echo chambers of comfortable, or at least familiar, beliefs. This is a generational struggle, one that will likely never end. Like in the universe of Douglas Adams, we have created this helpful and reassuring guide, which will prove invaluable on your skeptical journey, because the world is actively trying to deceive you and fill you with stories and lies. The forces of ignorance, conspiracy thinking, anti-intellectualism, and science denial are as powerful as ever. It's true that we have to struggle with these incredibly flawed meat machines in our skulls, but we are standing on the shoulders of giants. A lot of smart people over a very long time have thought and argued carefully about the nature of reality and our ability to understand it. We have some powerful tools, like science and philosophy. We do know stuff, and we have ways of making sense of it all. Don't panic. This whole notion of thinking for yourself and questioning everything is actually quite fun and empowering. We can do this together. Section 1. Core Concepts Every Skeptic Should Know. The truth may be puzzling. It may take some work to grapple with. It may be counterintuitive. It may contradict deeply held prejudices. It may not be consonant with what we desperately want to be true, but our preferences do not determine what's true. Carl Sagan. Before you start on any journey, you need the right equipment. So we'll grab the necessary tools, some trail mix and a good jacket, and put on a pair of comfortable shoes. In this section of our guide, we'll load you up with skeptical gear, like a fashionable utility belt. The things that we decided were the most important for the journey, things that at least will give you options to deal with the obstacles or pitfalls you might encounter on your way. These tools, your core concepts of scientific skepticism, can be broken down into 4 categories. The first set of skills comprise what I like to call neuropsychological humility. This category includes knowledge of all the ways in which your brain function is limited or flawed. The primary tool with which you probe and understand the universe is your brain, and we should all have a better understanding of how it works. The second category of skeptical gear is called metacognition, thinking about thinking. Metacognition is an exploration of all the ways in which your thinking is biased. This has obvious overlap with the first category, but focuses more on critical thinking skills than on the hardware of the brain. It would be nice if humans were perfectly logical beings, like a certain pointy-eared fictional character mentioned in the introduction, but we're not. We are emotional, semi-rational creatures plagued with a host of biases, mental shortcuts, and errors in thinking. The third type of skeptical equipment has to do with science, how it works, the nature of pseudoscience and denialism, and how science can go wrong. The fourth category of core concepts takes you on some historical journeys, reviewing iconic examples of pseudoscience and deception as cautionary tales. All of this skeptical gearing up is to prepare you for your adventure and get you started, or help you on your way if you've already begun. This isn't some weekend getaway. The journey is the rest of your life. Are you ready to become part of an epic quest? One that has taken us from huddling in dark caves to stepping foot on the moon? Yep, we really did that. Like all adventures, this one is foremost a journey of self-discovery. The monsters you will slay and the challenges you will face are mostly constructs of your own mind. But if you can master them, the rewards are indeed epic. Chapter 1. Skeptic's Guide Entry. Scientific Skepticism. Scientific skepticism, a term first popularized by Carl Sagan, is an overall approach to knowledge that prefers beliefs and conclusions that are reliable and valid to ones that are comforting or convenient. And scientific skeptics therefore rigorously and openly apply the methods of science and reason to all empirical claims, especially their own. A scientific skeptic provisionally accepts a claim only in proportion to its support from valid logic and a fair and thorough assessment of available evidence. A skeptic also studies the pitfalls of human reason and the mechanisms of deception so as to avoid being deceived by others or themselves. Skepticism values method over any particular conclusion. We ignore public understanding of science at our peril. Eugenie Scott. You are listening to The Skeptic's Guide because we advocate the overall worldview known as scientific skepticism. There can be a lot of confusion about what it means to be a skeptic, however. What do we do and what do we believe? Being a skeptic means doubting, but philosophical skepticism is distinct from scientific skepticism and is not what we advocate. Philosophical skepticism is essentially a position of permanent doubt. Can we actually know anything? And what is the nature of knowledge itself? Before science revolutionized our thinking, philosophical skepticism was a reasonable position. Most knowledge was based on authority and tradition, so wiping the slate clean by doubting everything was probably a step in the right direction. René Descartes famously said that all we really know is, I think, therefore I am. His idea was to eliminate everything that passed for knowledge up to that point, to start fresh, and then try to see what he could reason out from first principles, self-evident starting points. Luckily for us, we don't live in a pre-scientific age. There are hundreds of years of carefully worked out knowledge leading to where we are today. Philosophers focus on how to think in a clear, precise, unambiguous, and internally consistent way. Science works within a philosophy of methodological naturalism, all effects have natural causes, and uses a refined set of methods to check our theories against reality. We still can't know anything to 100% metaphysical certitude, but we can know things. We can methodically build a set of knowledge that is internally consistent and logically valid, not only consistent with what we can observe about reality, but that actually helps us predict how the universe will behave. That's why scientific skeptics are not philosophical skeptics, professing that no knowledge is possible. We are also not cynics, who doubt as a social posture or just have a general negative attitude about humanity. We are not contrarians who reflexively oppose all mainstream opinions. The term skeptic has also been hijacked by deniers who want to be viewed as genuine skeptics, asking the hard and uncomfortable questions, but are really just pursuing an agenda of denial for ideological reasons. We are scientific skeptics because we start with doubt, but we then carefully try to separate what we can and do know from fantasy, wishful thinking, bias, and tradition. I believe that modern scientific skepticism has several facets, not only a worldview, but also a body of knowledge and an area of expertise. Here are the tools and methods scientific skeptics use to help them parse reality. Respect for knowledge and truth. Skeptics value reality and what is true. We therefore endeavor to be as reality-based as possible in our beliefs and opinions. This means subjecting all claims to a well-founded process of evaluation. Skeptics believe that the world is knowable because it follows certain rules or laws of nature. The only legitimate method for knowing anything empirical about the universe follows this naturalistic assumption. In other words, within the realm of the empirical, factual knowledge based on evidence, you don't get to invoke magic or the supernatural. Promotion of science. Science is the only set of legitimate methods for investigating and understanding the natural world. Science is therefore a powerful tool, and one of the best developments of human civilization. Those of us who choose to be activists promote the role of science in our society. Public understanding of the findings and methods of science, and high-quality science education. This means protecting the integrity of science and education from ideological intrusion or anti-scientific attacks. It also involves supporting high-quality science, which requires examining the process, culture, and institutions of science for flaws, biases, weaknesses, and fraud. Promotion of reason and critical thinking. Science works hand in hand with logic and philosophy, and therefore skeptics also promote better understanding of these fields and critical thinking skills. Science versus pseudoscience. Skeptics are the first and often the last line of defense against incursions by pseudoscience. In this role, we seek to identify and elucidate the borders between legitimate science and pseudoscience, to expose pseudoscience for what it is, and to promote knowledge of how to tell the difference. If I had to say briefly what our core area of expertise is, it's pseudoscience. When countering common but false beliefs, it's not enough to understand the relevant science. You also have to know how science goes wrong, how people form and maintain false beliefs, and how they promote those beliefs. Such expertise is generally lacking within mainstream academia, and that's where skeptics come in. Ideological freedom, free inquiry. Science and reason can only flourish in a free society in which no ideology, religious or otherwise, is imposed upon individuals or the process of science and free inquiry. Neuropsychological humility. Being a functional skeptic requires knowledge of the various ways in which we deceive ourselves, the limits and flaws of human perception and memory, the inherent biases and fallacies in cognition, and the methods that can help mitigate all these flaws and biases. Consumer protection. Skeptics endeavor to protect themselves and others from fraud and deception. We do this by exposing fraud and educating the public and policymakers to recognize deceptive or misleading claims or practices. In addition, skeptics tend to be a source of institutional memory. The same scams and false beliefs tend to come around again and again. Seemingly, every generation has to make the same mistakes for themselves. It's useful to have those who study the history of scams, errors, and pseudoscience to help recognize and deflect such things when they inevitably reappear. While activist skeptics tend to be science communicators, we aren't just that. We have a particular expertise and niche, knowledge of pseudoscience, the mechanisms of deception, and how to counter misinformation. A generation ago, science communicators felt that all they had to do to counter belief in pseudoscience and myths was to teach science. We now know this is sadly not the case. For example, a 2017 study by John Cook et al., confirming prior research, showed that exposing people to misinformation about the scientific consensus on global warming had a polarizing effect based on political ideology. People who already accepted the consensus did so even more, and those who rejected the consensus held more firmly to their rejection. Correcting that misinformation had almost no effect on reducing this polarization. Facts were simply not enough to change people's minds. However, if you started by explaining to the subjects how fake experts can be used to falsely challenge the scientific consensus, the polarizing effect of this misinformation was completely neutralized. This is exactly why we choose to promote science partly by exposing pseudoscience and not just the false information of bad science, but the deceptive, sometimes self-deceptive, tactics that pseudoscientists use. It's not enough to just teach people science. You have to teach them how science works and how to think in a valid way. This audiobook is meant to be one giant inoculation against bad science, deception, and faulty thinking. No one is arguing that these are the most important issues in the world. Often, we're criticized for tackling one type of belief over another. But that's what we call the fallacy of relative privation, the notion that what you are doing is not valuable because there is a more important issue out there that needs attention. Don't bother doing anything until we cure childhood cancer, for example. I call this Gilligan's Island logic. Sure, if you are one of the few people stranded on a deserted island, you should tackle the most pressing survival problems first. But on a planet with over 7 billion people, that makes no sense. People should feel free to take on whatever issues are important to them, or where they feel their talents and inclinations lie. So when you hear the word skeptic in this audiobook, it means an advocate for science and critical thinking. Perhaps after listening to this audiobook, you will consider yourself a skeptic too. Neuropsychological humility and mechanisms of deception. Around the turn of the 20th century, the invention of the airplane, a heavier-than-air flying machine, was widely anticipated. In the decades leading up to the Wright brothers at Kitty Hawk in 1903, and even for a time afterward, there was a rash of sightings of such flying machines. Rumors of sightings would break out and engulf communities. Local newspapers would report how prominent citizens, police, the mayor, saw the ships and could even make out the pilot at the controls. Many people swore they heard the distant roar of the engine. Others reported finding debris dropped by the airships or even being taken for a ride in one. Often it was assumed that famous inventors like Thomas Edison were involved. We now know that all these incidents were hoaxes and mass delusions. There were no airships. Drawings of the alleged aeroplanes by the eyewitnesses resemble quaint notions of contraptions with flapping wings, not the planes that were eventually developed. What these and many other similar incidents reflect is the constructed and unreliable nature of perception, memory, and belief. They are the products of expectation, cultural influence, and psychology. When the Great Airship Hoax was eventually revealed to be just that, many people who'd been taken in were angry. I suspect, however, that they were mainly angry with themselves for being so gullible. But as we'll see, they were just being human. Chapter 2. Skeptic's Guide Entry. Memory Fallibility and False Memory Syndrome. There are numerous ways in which our memories are unreliable. In fact, entirely false memories can be easily fabricated, sometimes by misguided therapists. Cognitive psychology tells us that the unaided human mind is vulnerable to many fallacies and illusions because of its reliance on its memory for vivid anecdotes rather than systematic statistics. Steven Pinker. Our real-time experience of the world is fleeting. The moment after we experience something, it becomes a memory. First, a short-term memory, some of which is later consolidated into long-term memory. Everything we personally know about the world is memory. But how reliable is human memory? Think of a vivid childhood remembrance, the kind of memory that you recall often and that represents an important part of your history and identity. I hate to break this to you. Actually, no, I don't. But that memory is probably mostly or even entirely fake. You may find that notion disturbing. And right now you are thinking, no way. I clearly remember that trip to the toy store when I was 10. No way is that fake. But I'm sorry to say, a century of memory research is not on your side. Our memories aren't accurate or passive recordings of the past. We don't have squishy camcorders in our skulls. Memories are constructed from imperfect perceptions filtered through our beliefs and biases, and then over time they morph and merge. Our memories serve more to support our beliefs than to inform them. In a way, they are an evolving story we tell ourselves. Most people have had the experience of being in a heated conversation, and then once the dust settles and everyone tries to resolve the discrepancies, it becomes clear that each person has a different memory of the conversation that just happened. You may be tempted in these situations to assume your memory is accurate and everyone else is losing their mind. Of course, that's what everyone else is thinking about you. You may also have had the experience of reminiscing about an event long ago with someone who was there with you. On one episode of the SGU, Bob, Jay, and I were recalling a family trip to Pompeii and Herculaneum from our childhood. Bob and Jay clearly remembered an encounter with a strange tour guide who took perverse pleasure in pointing out every ancient depiction of a penis to our mother. My memory is that our mother told us of this encounter from her previous trip to Pompeii, but we never met the tour guide ourselves. Bob and Jay were shocked to learn that their memories were mostly fabricated, although they stubbornly insist it's my memory that's flawed. Researchers have learned much about the process of constructing our memories. As we will discuss in Chapter 3, Fallibility of Perception, what we perceive minute by minute is also an active constructive process. The various sensory streams are all filtered for the important stuff, assumptions are made about what we are likely perceiving, and everything is compared in real time to the rest and to our existing models and assumptions about the world. Preference is given to continuity, making sure everything syncs up. That perceptual stream then becomes a memory. Recent research suggests that short-term and long-term memories may form at the same time, but the short-term memory dominates initially and then fades quickly. Over a few days, long-term memory may consolidate and dominate. The actual relationship between short-term and long-term memory is likely more complex than this, and research is ongoing, but those are the basics. There are various kinds of long-term memory, and while they overlap considerably, they have different neuroanatomical correlates, involve different networks in the brain. There is declarative memory, also called explicit memory, which is factual knowledge stored in long-term memory and consciously recalled. This is what most people think of when they think of memory. Procedural memory, also called implicit memory, is more automatic and involves learning how to do motor tasks such as throwing basketballs or writing in script. Declarative memory is further divided. Episodic memory is memory of events and our own experiences. Episodic memories form what we call autobiographical memory, which is memory of what has happened in our lives, usually remembered in the first person. There is also a specific autobiographical memory known as a flashbulb memory, which is an unusually vivid memory of an emotionally significant event. Remembering where you were and what you were doing when you learned about the attacks on 9/11 or other similar events is a flashbulb memory. Semantic memory is factual memory about the world, not specific to your own experiences. Semantic memory also has different components, which are stored separately. We have memory for facts, a separate memory for the truth status of each fact, is it true or false, and a still separate memory for the source of the fact. This is why it is common to remember that you heard something somewhere, but you can't remember where and may not even remember if it's true or not. Memories are malleable. Memories are flawed from the moment we construct them, but they're also not stable over time. Each time we recall a memory, we are actually reconstructing and updating it. Memory, like perception, emphasizes internal consistency. We alter memories to fit our internal narratives about reality, and as those narratives change, we update our memories to fit them. The life of a memory is a chaotic adventure with many twists and turns. Here are some of the ways we mold our memories along the road. Fusion. We can fuse the details of different memories, mixing them up or even combining two separate memories into one. Consider that hypothetical trip to the toy store when you were a child. Perhaps you remember a scary encounter with a stranger in the store. But that encounter with a stranger may have happened at another time and place, and for some reason, you merged the experience with your memory of visiting the toy store. It's also possible that the scary encounter happened in a movie or to someone else, and you combined it with your own memory. Confabulation. Put simply, we make shit up. This is a completely automatic and subconscious process. Again, our brains want to construct a continuous and consistent memory, so if there are any missing pieces, it just makes them up to fill in the gaps. People with dementia tend to confabulate more because their failing memory and cognition creates more gaps for them to fill. In severe cases, it's possible to get patients with dementia to confabulate entire events that never happened, and they need little encouragement. Details are invented in order to emphasize the emotional significance of an event. In fact, the overall thematic and emotional significance of a memory is stored separately from the supporting details. In 2008, when asked about a trip to Bosnia a few years earlier, Hillary Clinton recalled, "I certainly do remember that trip to Bosnia, and as Togo said, there was a saying around the White House that if a place was too small, too poor, or too dangerous, the president couldn't go, so send the first lady. That's where we went. I remember landing under sniper fire. There was supposed to be some kind of a greeting ceremony at the airport, but instead we just ran with our heads down to get into the vehicles to get to our base." Clinton then fell victim to the age of video. In a video of the event found by the press, Clinton is shown walking casually with her daughter Chelsea without any apparent rush or fear. She even stops on the tarmac to greet a young girl. Hillary's account and the video record are in stark contrast. Clinton was widely criticized for, quote, lying about the event, but no such accusation is necessary. She remembers the fear and anxiety surrounding her trips to troubled parts of the world, and her brain could have easily filled in the details to support that emotional theme. In 1995, Elizabeth Loftus and Jacqueline Pickrell performed a study which has become known as the Lost in the Mall study. They interviewed older relatives of 24 subjects in order to create a booklet for each subject detailing four stories from their childhood. However, only three of the stories were true. The fourth was a completely made-up story about being lost in the mall. The subjects were able to recall some details about 68% of the true stories. However, 29% also remembered the false event either partially or fully. Some subjects could recount the false event in extreme detail and had high confidence in the accuracy of their account. In a 2010 study by Isabel Lindner et al., researchers found that simply observing another person performing an act can create false memories that we performed that act. They report, in three experiments, participants observed actions, some of which they had not performed earlier, and took a source memory test. Action observation robustly produced false memories of self-performance relative to control conditions. This research follows other research demonstrating that imagining an event is often enough to create the false memory of that event. Imagination activates many of the same brain areas that a true memory would. In essence, a memory of the imagination may over time become indistinguishable from a memory of a real event, and a false memory is born. This is especially relevant to many UFO abduction therapists who use hypnosis and encourage their clients to imagine themselves being abducted. This, quote, research is in fact optimized to produce, rather than uncover, false memories of alien abduction. A 2015 study by Julia Shaw and Stephen Porter found that many adults can be convinced that they committed a non-existent crime after just 3 hours of interrogation by police. She reports, "Our findings show that false memories of committing crime with police contact can be surprisingly easy to generate, and can have all the same kinds of complex details as real memories." In essence, our brains lie to us all the time. They tell us stories constructed from multiple sources, with details added as necessary to fill in any cracks. Personalize. There is a tendency to shift memories from happening to other people to happening to ourselves. If someone tells us an emotionally gripping tale of an encounter, months or years later, we may remember ourselves in the starring role, or at least as a direct witness. Perhaps that explains Bob and Jay's obviously false memory of Pompeii. NBC anchor Brian Williams may also have fallen victim to this phenomenon. Over the years, he's told the story of being in a helicopter that was forced down under fire while flying over Iraq. The problem is, His story has evolved over the years and differs from the memories of others who were there. It seems he has, in retrospect, personalized a story of another helicopter being forced down and merged it with his own less eventful helicopter trip. Williams was actually fired for, most likely, having the same flawed memory as everyone else. Contamination. We are social creatures. Part of our social nature is that we place high value on the testimony of others. When people discuss an event together, sharing details of their individual memories, they are likely to contaminate each other's memory. People will take details offered by someone else and seamlessly incorporate them into their own memories. That is exactly why courtroom witnesses aren't allowed to meet or talk with each other prior to giving their testimony. Distortion. Details of a memory can also simply change or be distorted. The details may drift over time, or they may change in a way specifically to support the emotional narrative of the memory. Memories can be distorted by suggestion. Merely suggesting a detail to someone while they are recalling a memory may cause them to incorporate that detail into their memory. If, for example, they saw a hooded figure and couldn't discern the figure's gender, an interviewer referring to the person as her could be enough for the memory to change to one of a hooded woman. The different elements of memory can also be distorted independently of each other. A 2005 study by Skernick et al. Supports the notion that we remember the truth status of facts separately from the facts themselves. It's as if we have a little checkbox next to memories to indicate if they are actually true. Skernick first exposed subjects to factual claims and told them that some of the claims were myths. An example might be, "It is a myth that vaccines cause autism." After 3 days, they surveyed the subjects and found that 27% of the young adults in the study misremembered false statements as true. The figure was 40% for older adults. Apparently, we don't pay as much attention to that little checkbox as we should. Confidence and accuracy. Perhaps one of the most iconic memory studies was by Neiser and Harsh in 1992, in which they looked at flashbulb memories related to the Challenger explosion. They gave 106 students in an introductory psychology class a questionnaire asking them to recall how they heard about the Challenger explosion, which had happened within the last 24 hours. They were given 7 specific questions about what they were doing and how they felt at the time. 2.5 years later, the same students were given a follow-up questionnaire. In this survey, they were also asked to rate their confidence in the accuracy of their memory on a scale from 1 to 5. Of the 7 details they previously recorded, on average, the students could remember only 2.95 of them. A quarter of the students scored 0 out of 7, and half scored 2 or less. In fact, only a quarter of the students even remembered taking the survey previously. Despite their terrible recall of the event, the average score of confidence in the accuracy of their memories was a whopping 4.17 out of 5. Other studies have also shown the lack of any relationship between confidence in a memory and its accuracy. We tend to think that vividness and confidence predict accuracy, but they don't. The clear lesson here is that we all need to be humble when it comes to the accuracy of our own memories. As we will hear, failure to appreciate the true nature of memory can create great mischief. False memory syndrome. Belief systems and myths have incredible cultural inertia, and they're difficult to eradicate completely. That's why belief in astrology, while held by a minority, persists. Professions, however, should be different. A healing profession should be held to a certain minimum standard of care, and that standard should be based upon something real, which means that scientific evidence needs to be brought to bear. Professionals, especially medical professionals, are not excused for persisting in false beliefs that have long been discredited. The 1980s saw the peak of an idea that was never based in science, the notion that people can suppress memories of traumatic events and those repressed memories can manifest as seemingly unconnected mental health issues, such as anxiety or eating disorders. The idea was popularized by the book The Courage to Heal, 1988, in which the authors took the position that their therapy clients, especially women, who had such issues should be encouraged to recover memories of abuse, and if such memories could be dredged up, then they were real. The concept of repressed memories led in part to the satanic panic of the 1980s, and many of those subjected to recovering techniques, quote, remembered not only being abused, but also being part of satanic ritual abuse. Recovered memory syndrome was a massive failure on the part of the mental health profession. The ideas, which were extraordinary, were never empirically demonstrated. Further, basic questions were insufficiently asked. Is there any empirical evidence to support the incredible events emerging from therapy, for example? Is it possible that the recovered memories are an artifact of the therapy and are not real? Now, with 3 decades of hindsight, we can say a few things with a high degree of confidence. Recovered memory syndrome is mostly, if not entirely, a fiction. People generally do not repress memories of extreme trauma. The existence of rare exceptions remains controversial. Further, as Elizabeth Loftus pointed out, memories are constructed and malleable things. Also, independent investigations by the FBI, other law enforcement agencies, and scholars never found any evidence of the satanic ritual abuse, murders, and other atrocities emerging in recovered memory sessions. The events simply never happened. What emerged from the entire SAD episode was an increased understanding of what is now called false memory syndrome, the construction of entirely fake memories. This is accomplished through guided imagery, hypnosis, suggestion, and group pressure. These techniques violate one of the basic rules of investigation. Never lead someone by putting words in their mouth. This is especially important if the person is vulnerable and confused. While there is some legitimate controversy over whether it is even possible to repress such memories and accurately recall them later, there is no question that the massive repressed memory industry of the 1980s and 90s was not evidence-based. It was essentially an industry creating false memory syndrome. The fact that a controversial idea was put into practice so widely, despite the risks to patients and their families, indicates a systematic lack of self-regulation within the mental health profession. More disappointing is the fact that recovered memory therapy is still ongoing today. Even if you wish to adhere to the minority opinion among memory experts that repressed memory is possible, the evidence doesn't justify the practice of recalling such, quote, memories. The potential for harm is more than sufficient grounds to suspend the practice pending further evidence. In 1990, George Franklin was convicted of murder after just one day of deliberation by the jury. The conviction was based entirely on the, quote, recovered memories of his daughter, who did not remember the alleged murder until 20 years after it occurred. Her memories of witnessing her father rape and murder her 8-year-old friend came back to her over time and under therapy after being, quote, repressed for 2 decades. There was no physical evidence to support the accusation. After serving about 5 years of a life sentence, Franklin's conviction was overturned and he was not retried, in part because of the misuse of recovered memory and hypnosis in the case. The jury was apparently impressed by the vividness and confidence of Franklin's daughter's memory, enough to give him life without parole. They shouldn't have been. Even when you aren't sitting on a jury, it's important to remember the true nature of memory. Whenever you find yourself saying, I clearly remember, stop. No, you don't. You have a constructed memory that is likely fused, contaminated, confabulated, personalized, and distorted. And each time you recall that memory, you reconstruct it, changing it further. When it comes to memory, be skeptical and humble. Unless the memory is of a trip to Pompeii, and then, of course, your brothers are wrong. Chapter 3. Skeptic's Guide Entry. Fallibility of Perception. The act of perception is a complex, highly filtered, and active constructive process by your brain. We do not passively perceive external stimuli like a camera. This constructive process introduces many possibilities for illusion and misperception. Our beliefs do not sit passively in our brains waiting to be confirmed or contradicted by incoming information. Instead, they play a key role in shaping how we see the world. Richard Wiseman. We have all marveled at optical illusions. One second you're looking at a picture of snow scattered over rocks, and then suddenly you're looking at a picture of a Dalmatian. Or perhaps you're looking at clearly wavy lines and then are informed that they are actually straight and parallel. You may have trouble believing it, so you get out a straight edge and damn, those wavy lines aren't wavy, they're straight. How can that be? We're a bit freaked out by really good optical illusions because they force us to directly confront a reality we tend to ignore as we go through our daily lives. What we think we see is not objective. It is a process of our brains, and that process can be fooled. Perception is constructed. The bottom line is this. Your real-time perceptions are not a passive recording of the outside world. Rather, they are an active construction of your brain. This means that there is an imperfect relationship between outside reality and the model of that reality crafted by your brain. Obviously, the model works well enough for us to interact with that reality, and that's actually the idea. Constructed perception is not optimized for accuracy, but rather for functionality. First, only a minute fraction of information from the outside world even makes it to the portions of your brain that construct your perception. Much of it is missed because your organs of perception aren't perfect, and there are numerous trade-offs. For example, only the tiny fovea of our eyes records images in any detail. This means that you have the potential to have 20/20 vision only in the area of a postage stamp held at arm's length. That small patch of vision, densely packed with light-sensing cells, carries about half the information from your retina. The other half is spread out over the rest of your retina. And for that part of your vision, you are legally blind. Outside the fovea, your vision is essentially a blurry mess. There's also a blind spot in each eye corresponding to the location of the retina where the optic nerve exits the eye. You don't perceive the blind spots or the blurriness because your brain weaves a seamless image out of this information. After, of course, a lot of processing. That processing crafts colors out of the information from the cones. It enhances edges, adjusts contrast, and also adjusts for apparent perspective. All of this has only created a two-dimensional image. Your brain also needs to process all the cues to distance, size, and relative position, make the best assumptions it can, and then construct a three-dimensional visual model out of this partial and heavily processed information. Hold on, we're just getting started. Now you have a crafted image, but it doesn't mean anything yet. The next area of the visual cortex assigns meaning to the image. Is that a tree or a whale? Okay, it finds a match, then makes further adjustments to the basic processing so that the image it constructed matches better with the thing it thinks it's seeing. Did you catch that? Visual processing is a two-way street. The basic visual information is processed up the chain as your brain constructs a meaningful image, and then the brain communicates back down the chain to tweak the construction so it fits better. Essentially, if your visual association cortex thinks you are looking at an elephant, it communicates back to the primary visual cortex and says, "Hey, make that look even more like an elephant." It changes what you actually see, not just how you interpret it. This all happens automatically outside of your awareness. And we're not done. Now you have a tweaked image of an object, but what meaning does this object have for you? Does it seem to be moving in a non-inertial frame, meaning that its movement does not seem to be just passively following gravity? If so, then it must have agency. Your brain then sends that visual stream along a different path and assigns emotional significance to the image. But wait, we need to animate all this. As objects move through your visual field, their images morph. the light plays across their surfaces. You don't want to be confused by this, so our brains smooth it all out over time so we see it as one object moving through our vision. All of this processing also takes time, a few hundred milliseconds. By the time we see that baseball flying at our face,